Hello and welcome to this Expert HR podcast with me, Noelle Murphy. Today we are looking at one of our oldest employment rights, redundancy, and the common pitfalls that employers need to avoid. I'm joined in the studio today by Max Winthrop from Short, Richardson & Forth, who is going to guide us through safe redundancy waters, as well as being the updating author of the termination chapter of our employment law manual. Max regularly advises employers on redundancy exercises and avoiding common mistakes. I thought it might be useful to start off with a reminder of the definition of redundancy.
Yes, well, what redundancy means is that it applies where an employer either closes a business or closes where an employee works within that business, or doesn't need employees to do work that's otherwise available.
Right, so in your experience, are most of the challenges to cases of redundancy on the basis that the redundancy itself is a sham, or is it around the way the employer has gone about making the individuals redundant?
Well, whilst there are cases where the tribunal finds that the redundancy is a sham, most of the work that I see involves an attack on the process that the employer has gone through to select particular employees for redundancy.
If we look at the actual process, there is a huge amount of information out there around what employers need to do. And I suppose one of the most significant areas is around meaningful consultation.
It is. That's a thread that runs through the whole of redundancy selection process. What we talk about when we're talking about consultation is we're really looking at giving the opportunity to have a consultation when ideas are still in their formative stage, making sure that the employees or the union you're consulting with has got adequate information and an adequate time in to respond to that information, and that whoever's party to that consultation is going to give a proper conscientious review of what material they've collated.
That's this thing around the proposal still being at the formative stage. That can be kind of an issue for employers, really, can't it, in practice?
It can be. It's a difficult question. And I should emphasise, I suppose, we're looking really here at individual rather than collective consultation. And I appreciate, of course, that a lot of HR practitioners will navigate a very narrow path between causing the whole workforce to be despondent because they think redundancies are coming. Mm-hmm. The other extreme is just not really telling anybody until a few days before a redundancy exercise takes place.
So it's about proposals being at the formative stage, isn't it? An employer needs to be prepared enough, and the proposal needs to be prepared enough so that they can realise the full implications if it were enacted. So they would need to know how many people they would need to make redundant, for example, in order to carry out the proposal. But at the same time, it needs to be at a stage where the company can consider counter-proposals.
Very much so, yes. If the employees, if the workforce, have sufficient time to think about the situation, you never know, they may come up with some really sensible ideas about avoiding redundancies. To spring a redundancy exercise on somebody with a couple of days' notice, it doesn't look good, and in most cases that's probably going to lead to a finding of unfairness.
But again, it has been shown time and time again that the consultation process has to be meaningful, but yet there is no kind of time limits applied to it when you're looking at making one employee redundant, etc. So the definition of what it can mean to be meaningful can be different from employer to employer and from organisation to organisation. So the guidelines that are here means, I think it's rather than about consultation, you need to be able to demonstrate that there's been a dialogue.
The purpose of that dialogue is to get out as much information as possible, and that there should be an exchange of that information. Who knows, that might lead to a different redundancy outcome than the employer originally thought.
Okay, so I suppose as we go through the process now, the next stage is really looking at selection and pooling.
That's right. If we're looking at let's imagine a fairly typical exercise, supposing you've got a workforce of 15 split into 3 5-person departments, and you're having to cut 3 jobs. Would that mean 1 job from each department, or would it mean 3 jobs in one department? Now, to an extent, the employer will have to apply their mind to that problem and say what's right for the business. But there can be arguments when the pool's too wide, or even when it's too narrow.
This shows up sometimes, the bluntness of the tool of redundancy, particularly when you're looking at pooling. In your experience, are there any concrete pieces of advice you can give to employers based on cases that have been through the courts?
Yes, I think what you've got to do is think about the situation. You've got to ask questions like whether the groups that you're proposing to pool are doing similar work to each other, whether employees' jobs are interchangeable, whether the inclusion of an employee in a particular pool is consistent with the roles that person's had in the past. It may be that you've agreed a particular unit with the trade union or with the works council, in which case, obviously, that's going to tell you what your pool would be. In terms of cases, I mean, a good example of this is a case called Contract Bottling and Cave. Mm. And what happened there was that the employer decided to it needed to reduce administrative staff, and it put all the administrative staff, whatever they did, whether it was accounts or whether it was sales, quality control, in one great big pool. And then they removed those with the lowest scoring, because it meant that some people who stayed then had to be retrained for the jobs that went. And because of that, the tribunal held that the process had been unfair. Two accounts staff there succeeded in a claim for unfair dismissal for that very reason.
Well, I mean, I think that demonstrates quite clearly how blunt the tool can be. When we look at pooling, can a pool of one ever be fair?
It can be, but I think it's one of those areas where you've got to exercise a degree of caution. Classic case of that, Capita Hartshead and Bayard, which involved the reduction in work for one particular employee, Ms. Bayard. However, the work she did, she was an actuary, was also carried out by three other employees. And the Employment Tribunal found the dismissal of Ms. Bayard to be unfair and said what the employer should have done in that case was to pool all four and decide who was the person that should go as part of that exercise.
So that sounds quite common sense, really, when you look at it all there in context. But I suppose that can be, once there's a process outlined, as there is with redundancy, employers can feel they're following the process.
Yes, they've got to really engage, and they've got to realise that it's not enough just to sort of say, this is how we're doing things. They've got to really think the process through.
So we have the organisation, the employer has spent some time and has set up its pooling scenario. When it comes to the selection process, is there anything in particular that an employer needs to be very aware of?
Yes. I mean, when I started in the legal profession, it was all pretty simple. There was one process, last in, first out, and that seemed to be about the extent of the sophistication. Things have changed a lot. What happens now is that employers will be expected to come up with a list of criteria that are at least up to a point objective and verifiable, rather than purely subjective opinions of one particular manager or not.
Have you any examples of criteria that on first appearance look and sound quite objective, but actually when they are put into play have shown not to be?
Yes, I mean, a good example is a case called Swinburne, Jackson and Simpson, and I'm sure there are some HR practitioners out there will take a certain degree of delight that this actually involved a law firm. What happened there was that the law firm had four commercial property lawyers, and they needed to reduce that pool of four by one. So they came up with what sounds like a really good objective list of criteria for selection. Selection criteria were length of service, skills stroke qualification stroke training, experience, timekeeping, disciplinary record, future potential, flexibility and performance. I'm sure we've all seen that sort of criteria being applied. Well, that sounds fine, but then they started to apply it. When the case went to the tribunal, and of course, decision makers are then subject to cross-examination, it all started to fall apart. So take, for example, that category of timekeeping. That sounds like the sort of thing you could objectively verify. You'd produce timesheets and all the rest of it. Well, in fact, there was nothing there. There was some vague evidence given that somebody had been to a meeting somewhere, but the person giving that evidence, when put on the spot, couldn't explain what meeting he was referring to. There were no kind of timesheets to show that somebody was consistently 15 minutes late each morning. So that fell away. Then you've got another criteria there, skills, stroke qualification, stroke training. Turned out, of course, that neither skills nor training were being measured, just qualification. And then when you applied it to the four, the one with the longest period of service qualification, that was the one that actually was selected. Mm. So the criteria weren't being applied in a rational, logical way. And not needless to say, the case just crumbled away, and what might have appeared to be a nice set of objective criteria still led to the employee winning that unfair dismissal claim.
So some of the criteria, two of the criteria there that you mentioned, such as, say, future potential and performance. Now, I can imagine they are criteria that sometimes or will kind of regularly find their way into lists. Was there any issue with the application of those criteria in this case?
Well, in that case, again, there seemed to be very little objective way in which those things could be measured. Mm. Now, I don't want to overemphasize that too far, because at another end of the spectrum, there are cases where tribunals have criticised employers for trying to adopt overly robust cases that are totally objective. There's a recognition by the tribunal that somewhere along the line there will be a bit of subjective input, but it's all got to be kept within kind of reasonable bounds. It's got to be proportionate to the task in hand. Mm-hmm. Now, you might get round that in part by, say, having somebody assessed by more than one manager, or that there's a system whereby you assess people, you score them without names being given. Somebody moderates that particular assessment process. Much depends, again, on the resources you've got, the size of the employer. Bigger the employer, the more they're going to be expected to have bomb-proof processes that might not be necessarily what you'd expect from somebody with only two or three employees.
But a lot of it is about how you choose and how you apply the criteria.
Absolutely. And again, back to that objective-subjective divide. You've got to have those criteria. You've got to apply them in a rational way. Funnily enough, there's another solicitor case that involved just that. The solicitor firm applied a set of objective criteria, but then the kind of tiebreaker was about a sort of generalised idea of how well people got on in the firm. Now, needless to say, using that, which hadn't been disclosed to the employee, cast a doubt over the process. What happened there was, in fact, the tribunal case ended up being remitted for the tribunal to look again as to whether that could ever be an acceptable process.
So where possible, when looking at selection criteria, an employer should try and include more than one person as the person who is devising the criteria?
Yes. There are various ways of doing that, and it'll depend a lot on your own business structure. There may be opportunities for more than one person to score. There may be opportunities for one person to score and then for a moderation process. There may even be the opportunity, or it may be a good idea, to give the person who's been scored the opportunity to challenge their own scores before the final decision on who goes and who stays has been made.
And I suppose this brings us to, once an individual has been chosen for redundancy, how an employer can manage the process to minimise the impact on those who remain in the organisation, but also to ensure fairness for the individual who is leaving the organisation.
Yes, and something I'm seeing a lot more of now than perhaps was common 10 years ago, there will be things like the employer arranging for outplacement counselling. Mm. They'll arrange for, if you're dealing with a workforce that has been with you for some years in particular, you may want to assist them in things like the production of CVs and assist them with how to deal with job interviews. Some of those employees who are leaving might not have undergone a job interview for a good many years. Mm-hmm. So is that continuing care for the welfare of the employees certainly won't do the employer any harm should it come to any potential tribunal claims.
So I think the one thing that's coming through as a common theme is about fairness, isn't it?
It is, yes.
The employer being able to show that as far as possible, each stage of the process has been as fair as possible, from the consultation process, the selection criteria that's used, how people are pooled, etc. And then finally, when the decision is made, that there's a certain level of fairness shown towards the employee who will be exiting through giving them the opportunity to appeal and also to access outplacement support or career transitioning support, as I think
yes.
it's sometimes called.
Absolutely, yes, very much so.
So I don't think there would be any conversation around redundancy and pitfalls that would be complete without mentioning people or women who are on maternity leave or shared parental leave, and there's a redundancy scenario that crops up.
Yes, I think there are a couple of areas that need to be sort of flagged up. And the first one, as you mentioned, is a woman on maternity leave. Everybody out there will probably be familiar now with Regulation 10 of the maternity and parental leave regs. What that does really is give that particular person the right to any vacancies that are going, so that that person, and of course now it could potentially be someone on adoption leave and shared parental leave, not just a nursing mother, that person would have the right to any vacancies that are available without having to go through, say, a competitive process to be appointed. So it's quite an overarching obligation. Don't forget as well, there's always a danger with women on maternity leave, you just forget about them while they're on maternity leave, and you may not have involved them fully in any process leading to the need for redundancies. Something else to watch out for. And of course, there's another area where rather similar considerations apply, and that's where the duty to make reasonable adjustments for a disabled employee engages. That might mean, for example, that if your selection criteria is very heavily dependent on absence monitoring, it could be appropriate to discount disability-related absences. It may be that you might have to adapt certain types of testing for somebody with a particular type of disability. Again, there's a range of issues there, but clearly you shouldn't simply blunder in and assume that a process that would work for somebody without a disability can be applied to a person with a disability without making those adjustments.
Okay, so it's interesting there to see how different areas of employment law come together, particularly when you're looking at selection for redundancy, etc.
Certainly, and I think it's always a little bit dangerous to think of any particular employment task along a groove of, say, this is just about redundancy. Don't forget that there are other rights, obligations that can intrude into that process, and what's fair for one person might need sensitive adjustment in other situations.
So alongside the redundancy process, there's obviously redundancy payments, and part of this can sometimes be payment in lieu of notice. Now, as we have you here, Max, I wonder, could you give us any comment on the changes to taxation of termination payments, which are due to come into force on the 6th of April?
So what happens at the moment? Let's say, for example, an employee has a clause in his contract giving him 12 weeks notice. If the clause is just that, that payment of 12 weeks pay can be made without deduction for tax and national insurance. Now, if that clause contained a provision which says the employer may make a payment of a sum equivalent to those 12 weeks, that's taxable. Now, that distinction is going to be swept away after the 6th of April. So even if there's nothing in the contract about the employer's entitlement to make a payment in lieu of notice, the payment of the sum equivalent to the employee's notice is going to be subject to tax. So any termination date falling after the 6th of April, if the employer was intending to, say, pay as well as redundancy payment a sum equivalent to the notice pay, they need to be aware that's going to be taxable from now on.
So just to be clear then, Max, these changes are going to come into force after the 6th of April?
Well, it's on or after the 6th of April.
So that's termination on or after the 6th?
Yes.
Thanks a million for that, Max. And if you want to delve deeper into any of those topics, we have a broad range of tools available on our Expert HR site. That brings us to the end of this Expert HR podcast. Thanks a million for listening, and we look forward to you joining us next time.